want you to make your way in your Bibles to the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. You ought to, if you haven't been here before, we've just been walking through Nehemiah together. We're in chapter 12, so we're at the very end. If you've been here before, you should know where Nehemiah is by now. You should have this little 13-chapter book well under control and know what's going on. And let me just put to fear any fears that you may have that, hey, it's about Christmas time. I'm just feeling like a lot like Christmas outside, and Pastor Sim's still not preaching a Christmas message. We're going to have plenty of time for that. In fact, next Sunday night, just a week from right now, we're going to have our Christmas concert here at church at 7. We're all inviting the whole church to join us on Sunday night next week, and it's going to involve everybody. It's going to involve the preschoolers and the children, our students, our worship band, our contemporary band, our choir. It's going to be fantastic. It's going to be about an hour and 15 minutes long. It's going to be awesome. They've told me some of the things that are in it. It's just absolutely incredible. I guarantee you it will just blow your mind, the talent. And besides that, I know you don't think I have much musical talent, and maybe I don't, but I've put together a band, and we're making our debut next Sunday night right here. All right? That in and of itself is worth coming for, I guarantee you. It may not be good, but it'll leave you talking about it, I can tell you that, all right? So we're going to have a good time, so don't miss that. We're going to have fun. Just to tell you, I mean, some of the members of my band just found out they were in the band last week. Like Doug McBee, he didn't even know he was in the band, but he's in it. He was so excited to hear that. So it's going to be good, so don't miss that. It's going to be fantastic. I want to talk about Nehemiah chapter 12. We're actually going to just talk about a section beginning down in verse 27 down through about verse 43. And I'll describe the setting for you in just a minute. But it's a great message for this time of the year because it's all built around the subject of happiness. Just, you know, really knowing what happiness is all about. A few years ago, I was actually in a bookstore, and there was a book there that I discovered. It's just simply called Happiness Found Along the Way. And it was just a book that just had a bunch of quotes in it about being happy, and they were pretty cool. I mean, for example, just give you some example of what people wrote. Happiness to a dog is what's lying on the other side of the door. If you have pets, if you've ever had a dog, you know exactly what they're talking about. They just lay at the bottom of the door and whine until you open the door and let them see what's on the other side. Here's another one somebody wrote. Happiness is hiring a babysitter that's on a diet. Now, that may be happy. If you got little kids, that may be happiness for you. Another thing, happiness consists of living every day as if it were the first day of your honeymoon and the last day of your vacation. That's a pretty good day right there. Happiness is the feeling you're feeling when you want to keep on feeling it. That's a good feeling in it. When you, hey, this is good and I just want to stay right here for a while. And then the last one is this. Happiness is discovering that the paper under your windshield wiper is just an advertisement, not a ticket. That's good. That's a good day, too. You know, there's a lot of descriptions. In fact, there was a description here for church services. It said happiness is finishing on time. And I don't know if that's a good one or not, but, you know, it just kind of makes the point. But as I flipped through the book, there were some great statements on happiness that really, really caught our attention, caught my attention. For example, Abraham Lincoln said, most people are about as happy as they make up their minds to be. It just kind of puts into a different phrase that little statement that says, your attitude determines your altitude, if you know what I mean. And another guy wrote, happiness resides not in possession and not in gold. The feeling of happiness dwells in the soul. And that's true. This is a matter of the heart. And then George Orwell said, men can only be happy when they do not assume that the object of life is happiness. Now the problem with happiness is, man, it's elusive. I mean, you have it one minute, and then you don't have it the next. You know what I mean? You go in the office one day, and there you walk by the cubicle next to you, and you say hello, and the person sitting in the cube, they're singing songs. And man, they're just happy, and they're, hey, how you doing? It's great to see you. Glad you're here today. And it just, they're on top of the world. And then the next day, you go by the same cubicle and say hey to the same person. They about bite your head off, and you think, what in the world happened from yesterday until today? But happiness is hard to hold on to. It's elusive. It's one of those things that we understand why people aren't happy. I mean, you look around the world, no matter where you live or what you experience in life, you can see the struggles that people face. I mean, families are falling apart and struggling. People have financial issues that bring crisis to their life. There are all kinds of things that we, you know, interpersonal relationship issues that we have, and then people lose their jobs. And so you start stacking up all the bad things that happen in the world, and it's easy to see why people aren't real happy. I mean, even yesterday, I mean, we had a funeral here yesterday for Angie that we prayed for last week. 30 years old, died of cancer, had a little 8-year-old. Well, you can understand why their parents would be grieving and why the people that loved her and knew her the best hurt yesterday and hurt today. I mean, there's things like that that happen all the time. But you know, in spite of that, in spite of all the struggles that we face, and in spite of all the things that we have to face in this world, God really desires for us to experience real and lasting joy. And it's a real and lasting joy that only He can provide. And Nehemiah chapter 12 kind of teaches us a little bit about that. And let me tell you what's going on. Let me just set it up for you. Remember what's taking place. Nehemiah was living back in Susa, 800 miles from Jerusalem. And some of his family went back to Jerusalem to visit. And they saw the city. And then they went back to Susa. And Nehemiah got back with his family and said, "Hey, how's the city and how are the people?" And they said, "Man, the city is in ruins. The walls are down. The city's in terrible shape. The people are discouraged. I mean, this is really a horrible situation." And Nehemiah was so gripped by that that he prayed for 4 months and sought God's heart. And God moved on his heart to be the man to go back to Jerusalem and rally the people to rebuild the walls. And so Nehemiah asked for permission from the king, and he sent him on his way, and he walked 800 miles back to Jerusalem and got there, inspected the walls, saw it was worse than he even thought in his life, and he rallied the people, and they rebuilt the walls. And that was a phenomenal experience. 52 days they rebuilt the walls. That was a God thing altogether. And then they recognized, you know what, we don't need more than a wall. We need to restructure this whole city. And so they got the government in place and got it all together. And then after doing that, they said, you know what, the outside of this place looks pretty good. But inside, we don't have any heart. I mean, we're lifeless. And Nehemiah chapter 8 describes what's called the revival at the Watergate. All the people gathered at the Watergate as one in this square as one man. And Ezra the priest got up on a platform. He opened the Word of God and began reading and explaining. And God brought great revival to the city. And then, you know what? They looked around and said, you know, we need more people in this city. We need to repopulate this place. And people started moving back into Jerusalem. And then Nehemiah said, you know one thing we've forgotten? All of this has happened in this city. This great revival that's taken place. This whole city, this place has been revived. I mean, God's really worked. Amazing work. We don't want to neglect giving praise and honor to God for what He's done, and we want to dedicate this wall to God. And so in Nehemiah chapter 12, and they've invited the Levites and the priests, and they got everybody together and said, hey, we're going to have this day, we're going to have this celebration, we're going to have an incredible party celebrating what God's done. And in verse 27, that's kind of the story that he begins to tell. And I want you to look at the words on the screen, because I'm going to skip around and get this together so that we can kind of keep it all together and understand what's going on. All right. So beginning now in verse 27, it'll be on the screen. It says, "At the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites in all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to celebrate the dedication with gladness, with thanksgiving, and with singing, and with cymbals and harps and lyres. And the sons of the singers gathered together from the district surrounding Jerusalem and from the villages. For the singers had built for themselves villages around Jerusalem. And the priests and the Levites purified themselves, and they purified the people and the gates and the wall. Then I brought the leaders of Judah up onto the wall and appointed two great choirs that gave thanks. One went to the south, on the wall to the dung gate, and Ezra the scribe went before them. And out the fountain gate, they went up straight before them by the stairs of the city of David, at the ascent of the wall above the house of David to the water gate on the east. The other choir of those who gave thanks went to the north, and I followed them with half the people on the wall. And the singers sang with Jezariah as their leader, and they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and children also rejoiced, and the joy of Jerusalem was heard far away." This was an all-out party taking place in Jerusalem. I mean, you just got to think about what's going on here. These people had lived in ruins their entire lives. And God had raised up Nehemiah. He'd come back to this city, and they rebuilt the walls, and they rebuilt the structure of the city, and they had a spiritual revival. Now they were connected once again to God and what God was doing in their life, and they were excited about it. And so they set this day aside as a day to have a party and celebrate what God had done. And so, and they call in the Levites and the priests. They divide up into two choirs, and Ezra takes one choir, gets up on the wall, and goes south. Nehemiah takes another choir, gets up on the wall, goes north. And I can't help but think when these people started walking up on the wall, you might remember when they were building it, what their critics said. They said, you know what, you're terrible wall builders. You guys don't even know what you're doing. If a fox jumps up on this wall, it's going to collapse. And now, and there are numbers of people up on the wall, some on the south, some at the north, and they're just having a party. I mean, they're just having a celebration up on the wall. In fact, I love what it says down in verse 43. It says this, "And they offered great sacrifices that day and rejoiced, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The women and the children also rejoiced, and the joy of Jerusalem was heard far away." I mean, the surrounding villages and towns heard what was going on in Jerusalem, and it was a different sound for Jerusalem. I mean, for a long time, the people that lived around Jerusalem, all they heard was complaining and mourning and weeping because the city was in ruins. Now God had done a great work, and they were hearing a strange sound. They were hearing a party, and these people are celebrating. They had a great happiness on this day. But I just tell you this, because of what's said in verse 43 and because of all that's told to us in the previous 11 chapters, we know this, that the happiness that they celebrated on that day was just the overflow of the joy that God had given them in working in their lives through Nehemiah and rebuilding the walls, restructuring the city, and bringing a great revival to their hearts. I mean, it was a phenomenal experience. It kind of reminds me of what is written in Psalm 126, down in verse 2. Listen to this. It says, "Then our mouth was filled with laughter, and our tongue with shouts of joy. Then they sang, they said among the nations, 'The Lord has done great things for them.'" And that's pretty phenomenal, isn't it? That's exactly what was going on. All the people are looking at Jerusalem, they're having this party, and they're saying, "Man, the Lord has done great things for them." And you say, how in the world does that relate to where I live today in 2010? I mean, we're almost at Christmas time. I mean, how does this experience even touch my life? I'll tell you how it does. You see, we've all had these kinds of experiences, haven't we? On top of the wall experiences. You know what I mean? We win, we celebrate, and it's a party for a day. You know, something good happens to us. You know, we get a new job, we make a new friend, we get a raise. You know, something good happens to us, and man, we're on top of the wall, we're on top of the desk, just having a party. But we've also had the other experiences too. We're not on top of the desk, we're under it. You know, life just kind of pulled the rug out from under our feet. We didn't see that coming. And what we thought was a day that was going to last, a day of joy that was going to last for a long time, it quickly disappeared, and we're just kind of left in misery. And I just want you to know, that's really not the way God intended us to live. You see, what goes on in our lives is not to determine the state of our hearts. And God's bigger than that. He wants to give us this joy that rises above all our circumstances and really makes a difference in us and in the world around us. I mean, it's an incredible kind of joy. And that's what I want to do tonight. I want to just write down four things about the joy that God gives. It makes it unmistakable and entirely different from what we can get from the world. And the first thing is this. And here's the answer. The question we're asking is this. Can I live on top of the wall? Oh, absolutely, you can live on top of the wall. I mean, you don't just have to stay there for a day. You can live your life on top of the wall. I'm not saying that life's going to be easy, but I can tell you this. When you have the joy of God in your life, everything else looks a little different. And here's the way it starts. You see, this kind of joy is produced from a right relationship with God. See, that's where it all begins for us. A right relationship with the God who reigns and rules above us. Now, I love this one chapter we're going to talk about. It's John chapter 15 in the New Testament. Jesus is doing this analogy. He's talking about He is the vine and we're the branches. And He abides in us, and we're to abide in Him. And if we do that, we'll bear much fruit. And He says, you know what? Apart from me, you can't do anything. You can do nothing. And that's a pretty powerful statement in verse 5 of chapter 15. But what's even more powerful after talking about that, and you know, you look at this whole description, and in this whole analogy, one of the biggest words is one of the smallest. It's the word in. I abide in you and you abide in me. He's talking about the dynamics of this relationship with God. It's an intimate relationship that really colors your world. It changes the way you look at things and the way you see things. It changes your perspective. And it makes all the difference in the world. This is what he says down in verse 11 as a result of you being in him and him being in you. He says this, "These things I've spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full." That's pretty awesome, isn't it? You know what he's talking about here? He's talking, he's saying, listen, I'm not here to give you this kind of surface happiness that leads you to jump up and down on top of your desk one day and hide under it the next. I'm here to give you a joy that really completes who you are. I mean, it fills you up, it lasts forever, and it's the kind of joy that I have. I mean, I really like the way he said this. He says, I'm here so that you, my joy may be in you. You just think about that a minute. I mean, the joy that God has can be in us. That's pretty phenomenal because God never gets shaken up by anything in this world. I mean, the sun didn't come up in America one day and things have changed for you. And God goes, oh man, I didn't know that was coming. That really troubles me. I don't know what we're going to do now. He never has that kind of experience. You see, every single day he is full of joy because he's holding the world in his hands. He's saying that kind of joy can be yours. And you know what? These guys in Nehemiah 12 knew that. That's why in chapter 12, verse 30, it says, "The priests and the Levites purified themselves and they purified the people and the gates and the wall." I mean, they knew that what they were talking about, the celebration they were participating in, was all because of just the resident joy of Jesus living in their hearts. I mean, it had changed everything for them. Here's the second thing I want you to write down. Not only does it come from a right relationship with God, but the joy that God possesses is his, and then he just gives it to us. I mean, again, that's what he says in verse 11. He said, you know the joy that I have? I'm going to give it to you. And it's going to be an absolute free gift. And sometimes that's a little hard for us to think about because we think we've got to work for it. We've got to earn our way into that kind of happiness. But I'll tell you something. What you're really looking for in life, God's give it to you if you'll just take it. I mean, if you're just willing to place your faith and trust in him, God himself will give you joy that lasts forever. I mean, that's pretty phenomenal, but he tells us he will. In fact, he tells us in Galatians chapter 5, verse 22, that the fruit of his spirit living in us, the second thing on the list is the word joy. And when God lives in you, when God reigns in your heart, I mean, he produces joy. It's not something you got to work up in your life. God will just give it to you. And that's a precious gift. You know, just 13 days, people are going to gather in living rooms all over the world. They're going to gather together and they're going to exchange gifts. And there are going to be people that are going to unwrap gifts. And man, they're going to be so excited. It really is amazing what happens on this day. And you open the gift and man, it's just what I put on my list. This is great, you know, and you're excited about that gift. But you know what? Just think about something. Can you remember what you got 5 Christmases ago? I mean, you remember what you got from your cousin 5 Christmases? Do you remember what they gave you 5 Christmases ago? The reason you don't remember, it was probably something you were really excited about, and you probably told them, man, this is awesome. This is just what I wanted. Now you don't even know where it is. It's in some junk drawer somewhere in your house or in the attic, or maybe it's already in the trash because you broke it about 30 days after you got it. And you know, but you know what? If we dug it out of the trash of the junk drawer and wrapped it up and gave it to you again this Christmas, you know what? You'd say, where'd you get this thing? I think I got this like 5 years ago from my cousin. I mean, what are you doing giving it to me again? This thing, I don't want this thing again. Let me tell you, the things that we give in this world, they just don't last. They don't keep producing the same kind of joy. But the joy that God gives, it just keeps on giving. I mean, it keeps on giving. It's a gift of God's grace every single day. And it's amazing. And if we'll take it, God will give it to us. It's a product of his presence in our life. Third thing I want you to write down is this. Personal faith results in this resident joy. You see, one of the neatest things about the joy that God gives, it's just an everyday thing. It doesn't matter if the day's been good or the day's been bad. It's an everyday thing. This resident joy that God gives, it's an amazing gift. Because when you have an intimate relationship with God and God's working in your life, man, you can hurt and grieve over bad circumstances or difficult situations, but it does not steal the joy that's in your life. It's amazing. In fact, when Christy was going through her infusion treatments at Emory, and every day we're making trips up there, and we're sitting for 6 to 8 hours up there in an infusion room with about 100 other people that are going through chemo treatments. You look around the room and the walls are gray and the lights are dim, and you look at the people that are in there, and they're all at different stages of battling cancer. There's not a whole lot of hope in that room, and there's not a whole lot of joy or laughter. Now, there's a whole lot of sadness and despair. And I was just sitting there and decided that, you know, I'm going to read through the New Testament. While I'm just sitting here and sitting with her and trying to help her, I'm going to read through the New Testament. In just a couple of weeks, I read through the whole New Testament. I was just marking verses. And along the way, God reminded me of a verse I'd read a long time ago, but just kind of got buried in all the verses that are found in the Bible. Just kind of got hidden. And it's Romans chapter 15, verse 13. And I want you to listen to what it says. It's just a prayer, and it's something that Paul said. He said, "May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit you may abound in hope." Man, that's a great verse to read when you're in the Emory Cancer Institute and you're surrounded by people that are taking chemotherapy, and a lot of them have been told, hey, the outlook isn't so good. You want hope in the middle of those circumstances. The only way you're going to get it is if God gives it to you. But what he tells us in that passage is really insightful. I mean, I love what he shares with us. He's saying, hey, I want you to get this. I'm praying that God will give you joy and peace in believing. He's saying, hey, you've got to have faith. This faith relationship with Jesus results in a resident joy. When you put your trust in Him, in Him alone, it changes everything. God is the source of your joy. You see it? Look, think about this for a second. If you're just putting your joy for who you are in your job and you lose your job, what happens to your joy? It's gone. Now, even if you put it in something really good like your own family, and then all of a sudden circumstances change in your family, what happens to that joy? It's absolutely gone. I mean, your world is torn apart immediately. You see, when you put your dependency and your faith in anything but God, your absolute trust for hope in anything else but God, listen, when that part of your world starts shaking, your joy is gone. You need to put your faith and trust in God. And what he tells us in this passage, in believing, if you'll trust him and put your faith in him and put your hope in him, you know what? He will give you joy and peace that's unimaginable. Now, I was just talking to somebody, and I was using an illustration when I was talking to him about something that God taught me a long time ago, about just a scale, a balancing scale. And if you know, look at one of those old-timey scales that had a fulcrum that touched the ground, and then the scale sat on that. And then there's, you know, there's little chains and there's little baskets hanging off the ends of the scale. You remember those? You remember seeing those? You may have never used those in your life, but you know what I'm talking about? You know what's amazing? That's a scale to balance things, and there's only one point where it's touching the ground. I mean, it's got soul balance because of one point. It's grounded in one place. And that's a great picture of what if we really trust in God, that's what our belief needs to look like. We just have to have one place. We're putting all of our weight in one place. And God becomes the fulcrum that's holding up everything else in our life. Now, you know, if you've got a whole bunch of places that you're touching and, you know, all of a sudden something in the family happens or your job happens, all of a sudden your whole life's out of balance and your world's shaking. But if you know what, if you're putting all of your trust in God, you just got one place where you're grounded and somebody takes all the fruit out of one side and it leans over, it might shake you a little bit, but guess what? You're still grounded and you still got joy. So he didn't change everything because Jesus is your everything. And he gives you real joy. Here's the last thing I want you to write down. The joy God gives supersedes emotional happiness. That's the best thing about God's joy. Emotions are good. And to be honest, most of us ought to express them a little more when we come together for praise and worship. I mean, we get a little intimidated by singing and celebrating, and we get a little reserved. And we ought to do a better job at expressing them. But I tell you, if you just live on emotions, that's a horrible way to live, isn't it? Yeah, you ever heard this description? They're an emotional basket case. You know what? They're talking about somebody that lives off their emotion. I mean, one minute they're up on top of the world, the next minute they're down. I mean, they're all over the place. They're just living by their emotions. That's a horrible way to live. The joy that God gives supersedes emotions. And you say, how do you know that? I'll tell you how I know that. Because there's so many places in the New Testament where it calls on us to be filled with joy, and it's humanly impossible. You just can't do it. Let me give you some examples. James chapter 1, verse 2 says this, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds." You read something like that, you ought to stop and think about it a minute. You hear what James said? He says, you count it all joy when you meet trials of various kinds. Let me ask you a question. You ever bumped into somebody and said, "Hey, how you doing?" They said, "Oh, man, I'm doing fantastic." "Really? Why? What's going on?" "Oh, I've had one trial after another all day long. This has been a messy day, and I am so glad." Nobody ever says that. "Man, when it's life on easy street, then it's good. But when things are bad, I'm terrible." Or as Charles Barkley would say, "I'm terrible, terrible, terrible." I mean, he just things are bad. They're awful. God challenges us. You count it all joy when you suffer trials. Let me give you another example. 1 Peter chapter 4. "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice in so far as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed." One more verse to connect to that. Romans 5:3. "More than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance." Do you get that? That's crazy, isn't it? He's connecting rejoicing and suffering. The Apostle Peter's doing that, and Paul's doing that. Connecting joy and suffering. I mean, that's odd to us. That's humanly impossible, isn't it? But that's the kind of joy that God gives us. Even when our circumstances are impossible for us to muster up the strength to have joy, God gives it to us. Last week, when I called Angie and talked to her, I mean, the doctors had told her about 4 or 5 days earlier that she had 2 weeks to live. She's 30 years old. She's got an 8-year-old daughter. And that's pretty devastating news. I don't care how old you are. When you're staring at a doctor and they say, "Hey, you got about 2 weeks." That'll shake your world if you're not balanced properly. And I'm talking to her on the phone, and she's just bubbling over with just not just optimism. I mean just genuine faith and trust in God. Now, I get to the end of the conversation. I say, "Angie, just, all right, how are you doing? I mean, how are you doing?" And she could tell, I think, by the sound of my voice on the phone that I was worried about her. I was more concerned about her. And she said, "Pastor Tim, don't worry about me. It's all good. God's got it all under control. I'm going to be fine." Now, she wasn't saying, when 2 weeks is up, I'm not going to die. Because that very day she was having the birthday party for Danielle, whose birthday was on the 20th. So she knew, we need to go ahead and have this thing because I may not make it. And she didn't, to the 20th. But I can tell you, in the midst of one of the greatest crises in her life, she had the joy that only God can give. That's amazing, isn't it? I can tell you this. And Billy can tell you this. His wife, Cassie, would spend a lot of time at the hospital. The spirit and attitude and hope that she had in the midst of that is an encouragement to everybody that walked in that room. It's remarkable. Only God can do that. Only God can give you that. We humanly, we just do not have the ability to do that. Now, here's the thing I want you to get. Go back to Nehemiah 12. They're having a party. Probably everybody in town is on that wall because joy is contagious. And they're looking at those singers and guys playing cymbals and harps and all that stuff going on. They look at all these people singing on the wall. That whole town probably climbed up on the walls. And everybody around them heard the joy from their celebration. Now, as a believer, as a person who knows Jesus, who has a relationship with God, I mean, we're at a time of the year when we're celebrating the most remarkable expression of love mankind has ever known. When God Himself took on the flesh and came to this earth. That's amazing. If the world's going to get it, they're going to get it from you and me. If they're going to see it, they're not going to see it on a sign or a window or a billboard. They're going to see it in you and me. You see, God, they have such an incredible presence in us that wherever we go, people see the joy that's in our life and they can see it from far off. When we talk, they hear it. As we live, they see it. At work, they experience it. In our neighborhood, they know something's different. And it's all because of Jesus. See, the challenge of chapter 12 is, listen, let's live life out loud. Doesn't mean we need to try harder. We just need to put our faith in the right place and God will give it to us. You know, in the middle of that revival, in Nehemiah 8 and 9, Nehemiah had to remind the people of something when they were weeping and crying because of their sins and failures. He said, hey, it's a time to rejoice because the joy of the Lord is your strength. Let people see the Jesus in you. Live life out loud. And let's just pray that the people even far away, they're four rows down at checkout stand number 8 and you're at number 12. They ought to be able to look down in their miserable state of trying to find their presence and say, hey, there's something different about that guy. You can see it in his face. You can hear it in his voice. There's joy in his life. And I want that. And let God use us to share his love and grace so that other people can share in that same joy.